Well, Happy New Year. I realize that many of you may think of Dave, your week off. Last Sunday was a Sunday for Happy New Year, but last Sunday I was in Nashville visiting my son and daughter-in-law, so was not with you, but it is good to be back. And while I was down in Nashville, I came up with some kind of upper respiratory deal, so if I start coughing at all during the message today, please bear with me. And now as everyone that I shook hands with starts running out to the bathroom to wash their hands, it's okay. Every time I approach my wife in our home over the past week, she pulls her sweater right up over her head. So anyway, I want to start my message this morning by having us read together one verse from the very beginning of the Bible. Genesis 1:1. Let's read that together. Let's do it one more time. In
the beginning.
You know, I believe we lose sight today of how incredible those words were to those hearing them for the very first time. And because our culture has been so shaped by the teachings of the Bible, we often take for granted the wonder in that simple statement. But the impact those words would have had on those hearing them for the first time would have been life-altering. I mean, think for just a moment, if you had never heard before that there was one God who created all things, how that revelation might impact your entire view of the world around you and of your place in it. Up until when these words were written, the prevailing view of the divine was one of many gods who were both limited in power and extremely immoral. In fact, the gods were thought to be quite petty and fickle. So you had to live in constant fear that one of these gods might wake up on the wrong side of bed and send a plague to destroy you and your entire family. This view led to people to engage in horrific practices such as human sacrifice and infanticide as a way to try to win favorable treatment from these fickle and unpredictable gods. This view of the gods was coupled with a very low view of humans, as it was thought we existed simply to do the work the gods did not want to do. And since the gods were believed to be petty and fickle and always in conflict with one another, the people just followed their lead. And the goal was to dominate rather than to serve others. You know, a very typical prayer of this time was one in which you cursed those you did not like. And life was just an endless cycle. A person was born to live and die without any meaning or purpose at all. There was no ultimate authority in the world moving history to a divine conclusion. You lived a life that was hard, harsh, and without hope. And then into this horribly destructive worldview, the writer of Genesis sits before a scroll and writes these incredible words, "In the beginning, God, an all-powerful being outside of this world, created the heaven and the earth." Seven words that change the world and that resonate down to us in this room this morning. And I want you to note how the writer goes out of his way to distinguish between the Creator and his creation. Up until now, the people had made gods of created things, such as the moon and the sun. Look at how the writer addresses that in his creation account. Back to Genesis. First chapter, picking up at verse 3. "And God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evidence, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day." So we have day and night on the first day. Simple question you may not have thought about. Has the sun been created yet? No. Let's read on. All the way to verse 14. "And God said, let there be light in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day." God creates the sun on the fourth day. The writer makes it abundantly clear that the sun and the moon had very definitive beginnings. They were not divine. They were created by an all-powerful God who did not need any help from them at all in order to generate light. This, I believe, is God's way in the very beginning of his word to mankind to tell us how wrong it is to worship creation instead of who? The one who created it in the first place. Now, Paul addressed this folly of in the book of Romans, Romans 1:25. He says, they, talking about people from ancients, exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Aren't we glad we are so much more sophisticated today than those pagans were back then? I mean, we would never worship created stuff, would we? Now the gods we worship have names like Mercedes and Coach. So if this is my introduction, this morning we embark on a new series entitled, Why We Believe. And in this series, Pastor Mark and I will be addressing the fundamental truths that form the basis of the Christian faith. And this series, we believe, is important for a number of reasons. First, for the purpose of building into each Christ follower in this room a sense of confidence in the intellectual reasonability of what we believe. Now, this is not to say we will provide such compelling intellectual support that you no longer need faith. If I could do that, I would be God. But we do want to show that belief in the gospel is not, as our culture would like to tell us, some kind of ridiculous leap of faith, but is rather a very reasonable step of faith based on the evidence God has given us. And then there's a second reason why this series is important, and that is to prepare us all to meet the biblical command set out by the Apostle Peter when he wrote this in 1 Peter 3:15. But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And do it with gentleness and respect. This is the verse from which we get the word apologetics, which simply refers to the discipline of defending a position or a teaching. In this case, the gospel message. If you read the book of Acts, you see numerous examples of the apostles offering well-reasoned defenses of their faith. You can read on your own Stephen's speech in Acts 7 or Paul's address in Acts 17. And the ability to provide a reasoned defense for that which we believe was not meant to be just something that the apostles needed to be able to do. It was not intended by God to be an elective in the Christian walk. 2 Corinthians 10:5. I don't know if I've ever looked at this in this context before. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. See, my friends, it is only by responding to honest questions with biblically sound answers that we can take every thought captive to Christ. So with that said, I commence the series with the most basic of building blocks to what we believe. And that is, we believe that there is a God. Because if there is no God, this would be a very short series, okay? And for those of you who might be thinking, okay, Pastor Dave, we all believe in a God. Can we just move on to the next topic? I am reminded of how John Wooden, Hall of Fame basketball coach at UCLA, used to start his first practice of the year. As the new recruits breathlessly awaited what brilliant lessons he would impart to them about dribbling or shooting, he would walk in that first day, and the first drill he would have them do started with the directive for them to take off their shoes and socks. And then he proceeded to teach them the proper way to put them back on so that they would not bunch up. And then as he got up to leave and the players were looking at each other wondering, what did that 30-minute tutorial have to do with winning a basketball game? He turned to them with a glint in his eye and said, boys, if there are wrinkles in your socks, you will develop blisters. With blisters, you will miss practice. If you miss practice, you won't play. And if you don't play, we won't win. If you want to win championships, you must pay attention to the smallest of details. So this morning we will start with the first fundamental building block of the gospel message, and it is simply that there is a God. Now, for most of you, you'll respond, of course there is a God. But you know, I think I've found over my 22 plus years as a pastor that even among committed Christ followers, there are those vulnerable moments where a little bit of doubt can creep in. And that thought pops into your mind, what if I'm wrong? What if there is no God? I mean, nobody's ever seen him. So both for ourselves, to respond to any doubts the evil one might try to use to infiltrate our minds and to keep us from being willing to risk our entire existence on his existence, and to make sure we are prepared to respond to questions raised by others about his existence. Together, examine some of the evidence of God. Now, there are basically three options a person has with regards to this question. One, he exists. Two, he does not. And three, I'm not sure one way or the other. Let's look together at each of these, okay? The first option is defined by the term theism. Now, in its full meaning, theism describes a person who believes in a supreme personal God who is outside of the universe he created, but at work within it. For purposes of this message this morning, we won't address the personal nature of God. That will be addressed in upcoming messages. But theism describes a belief that God exists outside of the universe that he created. A second option is the word atheism. Theism, God with the term alpha or a meaning no. So, no God. And just as an aside, I would submit to you that there are few, if any, true atheists in the world. A true atheist would be someone who, after exhaustive research of the evidence, determined there was no God. And there are those who have tried to do this and ended up finding God in the process. But the simple truth is, it is philosophically impossible to prove that a thing does not exist. I mean, you cannot even prove that the Easter Bunny does not exist. All you can do is say, in all my life experience, I've never seen him. But no one can with absolute certainty say that somewhere in the vast universe there is not one, right? So it is philosophically impossible to prove that God does not exist. So I would argue that many people who claim to be atheists have never seriously looked at the evidence. They simply found belief in a God inconvenient and so chose not to believe in him. C.S. Lewis, the famed Christian apologist, was, before coming to Christ, an atheist. And he shared how difficult a conundrum this created for him, because he found himself in the conflicted position of not believing that God existed while at the same time being mad at God for not existing. And as he searched the evidence, he found God. Well, then there's a third option, agnosticism. A or no, and in this case, knowledge. This simply says, I cannot know if God exists. Many people who call themselves agnostics, I would say, are simply lazy. They have never studied the evidence to say it is impossible to know if there's a God. They just say, well, if he's out there somewhere, I've not located him. And most of the time, they have not actually looked very hard. They don't know if he exists, and they're not necessarily interested in finding out if he does. Because if they do find him, they might then have to change some things to conform their lives to this God. So they don't know, and they don't care. And sadly, friends, before we start pointing figures, many theists are not much different. Although they say they believe in God, that belief is not very deep. They are a little like the elderly man who was traveling with his children on an airplane for the first time. It was the first time flying because he was very afraid of flying, and that had kept him off planes until this one time. Well, the plane took off, landed, and his son said to him, now, Dad, that wasn't so bad, was it? To which the dad responded, I'm still not sure I trust those things. Not once the whole time we were in the air did I ever put my full weight down. You know, there are a lot of people in church who are theists in name, but who treat God a lot the same way that that elderly man approached that airplane. We believe in him a little bit, but not enough to give our full weight over to him. And this is so dangerous. Chad Walsh wrote this in his book, Early Christians of the 21st Century. And I quote, "Millions of Christians live in a sentimental haze of vague piety. Their religion is a pleasant thing of emotional quivers, divorced from the intellect and divorced from the will, and demanding little except lip service to a few harmless platitudes. I expect Satan has called off his attempts to convert people to agnosticism. After all, if a person travels far enough away from Christianity, he is in danger of seeing it in perspective and deciding that it is true. It is much safer from Satan's point of view to vaccinate a person with a mild case of Christianity so as to protect them from the real thing." That, my friends, is a pretty tragic yet accurate description of many people filling church seats in America today. And I would ask, is it true of you? Okay, let me get off my soapbox and let's take a look at what I believe are the three major evidences for believing in God. The first is referred to as the cosmological evidence. This comes from the Greek word for universe, cosmos, and goes like this. The fact that anything exists demands a creator. Now, this is essentially the argument that Paul makes in Romans 1:18 through 20, when he said, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." The Apostle Paul there in essence says that for a person to claim there is no God makes no sense. Because the fact that you are here in the first place to question God's existence means there must have been someone who put you here in the first place. Put another way, the very fact that there is a here for you to be and to wonder if God exists necessitates a God who created you and the rest of creation. See, if you do not believe in the existence of God, you have only two options to explain the existence of the universe and everything in it, including you. Either it came into being totally on its own, or it has been in existence for all eternity. So let's look at the first option. The universe came into being on its own. This would be the argument of those who believe in the Big Bang theory. But even if you hold to that explanation, you do not have an answer for where the material and energy came from to create the Big Bang in the first place. To which one might respond, okay, you're right, I don't have an answer for that. But then neither do you, Pastor Dave, have an answer for where your God came from. To which I would respectfully respond, you're right. I cannot explain where God came from. But to believe in a God whose origin is unknown and who exists outside of the universe but created the universe, that still makes a lot more rational sense to me than to believe that nothing suddenly became something. Not only something, but a universe so massive that the human mind cannot even grasp it. See, all the Big Bang theory gives you is one way that God may have created the universe. Let there be light. Boom. But it does not explain how something came from nothing. So how about the second option? That the universe has always been in existence, that it is eternal. Well, that theory runs afoul of the law of entropy. Now, I did not ace my physics class in high school, so any of you physics majors can challenge me perhaps afterwards. But as I remember it, this law teaches that energy always gets used up, all right? This is the principle behind a battery. You place a battery in a flashlight, and it will work for a while, but eventually it will run out, and you will either need to replace it or recharge it. Well, if the universe with all its energy is like one big battery, right, because it's constantly burning off energy through burning of stars, it could not logically burn forever. It would eventually burn out. So it could not have been around forever. I mean, even the energy in the battery of that famous rabbit given us by Madison Avenue, right? The Energizer Bunny, that eventually runs out. Now, it might last for a long time, but not forever, not for all eternity. So the universe could not have existed for all eternity. And if you think it can, then you have reduced the entire universe to one gigantic version of my wife. She just keeps going and going and going. But yes, friends, even she wears out eventually. The second set of evidence, that's what I'll refer to as the moral evidence, is set out brilliantly by former atheist C.S. Lewis in his landmark book, Mere Christianity. And it says this: morality is essentially the same in all cultures. And if this is true, then there must be an objective standard of right and wrong built into the fabric of the universe by the God who created it. Again, let's look at how the Apostle Paul states this. Ephesians 2, 14 and 15. And here, just made it, when it says Gentiles, those are just those that did not have the Bible. And when it talks about the law, that's like the Bible. So I'm going to just substitute Bible for law here every time as we go through it, okay? Indeed, when Gentiles do not have the Bible, do by nature things required by the Bible, they are a Bible for themselves, even though they do not have the Bible, since they show that the requirements of the Bible are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them. Paul is saying that in every culture, the people will appeal to an objective standard of right and wrong. If someone takes something which belonged to another person, that person will express their anger. It is the same in the jungles of Africa as it is in the jungles of corporate America. It is instinctive, not sociological. I mean, any three-year-old child in any culture, if you take their ball, will say what? No. Fine. How does he know it is not right for someone to take the ball from him? He knows because the word of God is written on his heart. And the fact that there is a universal law written on every human heart provides evidence there must be someone who placed that law there. You say, well, there are some people who did not have this moral sense. I mean, look at the Nazis. They were not bothered at all stealing from others. Okay, what would they have said if someone stole from them? Right? Their consciences may have been so seared by their sin as to not been troubled by what they did to others. But if one of them stole from a fellow Nazi, watch out. You say, oh, but David, I know this man who says he does not believe that lying is wrong. Okay, go try to lie to him. I bet you he will appeal to a standard you violated. And if there is a law, there must be a lawgiver. And then finally, the third and final set of evidence is a teleological evidence, which comes from the Greek word for purpose. And that argument is that this universe has such order to it, it must have been formed by an intelligent creator. Beautiful Psalm 19, 1 through 4. Let's just pick it up with the heavens and let's read it together. The heavens declare. David says, just look at the night sky. Pierre-Simon Laplace, a French scholar who was very active in astronomy, would say this: it is as likely that a handful of pencils thrown at a piece of paper would produce a flawless copy of Homer's Iliad that the order of the universe could come about by chance. I mean, let's just look at some of that order. Start with the distance the Earth is from the sun. A little bit closer would be a desert. A little farther, a frozen tundra. How about the tilt of our axis? 23.5 degrees, allowing all parts of the planet to be exposed to the sun's rays without any part, major part of the planet would be uninhabitable. How about the mixture of gases in the atmosphere? We have just the right balance of nitrogen and oxygen to enable us to breathe. A mixture, by the way, that exists in no other planet in our solar system. How about the ozone level? It filters out those of the sun's rays that would kill us while allowing through those we need for life. And I could go on and on. Is this all just some massive coincidence? Aristotle said, the beauty, order, and harmony of the universe is an expression of the will of God. Albert Einstein said, "I pity the man that says there isn't a supreme being. Everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humbled." Yes, you can assume all this came into being by chance, or you can recognize that for every design, there is a designer. You know, I found it interesting, my study preparing for this message, the Hebrews, the ones for whom the scriptures were given, they did not even have a word comparable to our word for nature in their language. Why? Because they understood that the world could not exist on its own naturally, but it was a creation of God. He made it, He sustains it, and they saw God's fingerprints all over it. Don't you? Tonight, just go out and look at the night sky and marvel and give thanks to God for His creation. So why then, in light of all this, would someone say there is no God? I don't believe it is as much because of an intellectual belief, a matter of the mind, as it is a heart response, a matter of the will. Psalm 14:1. The fool says in his heart, the psalmist says, that there is no God. The fool. Now, the meaning for the word fool is used by the psalmist is different than how we would use it. To this writer, it would be better translated, the immoral person says in their heart, in his or her heart, that there is no God. And why would an immoral person not want to believe in God? Because that lack of belief brings with it a lack of accountability. So they can live life any way they want. And to quote from that famous philosopher John Lennon, whatever gets them through the night is all right. And not believing in a God allows them to live a self-centered life and to justify it in their minds. Again, we looked at this earlier, Romans 1:18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Did Paul say they suppress the truth by the facts, by the evidence? No, it's because of their lifestyles, living life as they please without any ultimate accountability to a God who made them. And where does this ultimately lead? Verses 21 and 22. For although they knew God, they neither glorified Him as God nor gave thanks to Him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. No, my friends, the evidence says there is a God. And you know, deep down, we all realize that. Even before I had the incredible blessing of getting to know this God personally, when I gave my life to Christ just after graduating from college, even before that, as a teenager and in college, I would often sense Him out there somewhere. The brilliant mathematician Blaise Pascal said this, "The evidence of God's existence is more than compelling. There is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of a man that cannot be filled by anything except God." Perhaps the greatest argument I have for His existence is that vacuum did exist in my heart. For 23 years, I tried to fill it with everything but God. High school, I tried to fill it with athletic achievement. In college, I tried to fill it by being a fraternity big man on campus. None of it worked. I just found myself lost and empty until in 1977, in a dorm suite in High Point, North Carolina, I came to ask Him to fill that God-shaped hole when I placed my faith, my trust in His sending His Son Jesus to die on a cross to pay the penalty for my sins. So how about you? That hole is there in you as well. And you can try to fill it with money or possessions or relationships. And yet all of the toys or the fame that this world can provide, you will still have that vacuum, that hole, because it can only be filled by God. We're going to close now, and I'm going to thank Brad because he's going to lead us in that incredible, incredible hymn. And then John, is he coming up here? And Cindy, others on the team. Right? We're going to close with How Great Thou Art, an incredible hymn of this great God who created this world and everything in it. And then come back next week as we continue down the path as Pastor Mark brings a message on the Word and how we know the reliability of that as it leads us down the path from this God to the personal God of Jesus Christ.